This is Audible.
Podium Audio presents He Who Fights With Monsters 3, Book 3 of He Who Fights With Monsters, written by Shirtaloon, performed by Heath Miller. Chapter 1. A Question You Don't Yet Know to Ask. Jason Asano and his team of fellow adventurers were living in a houseboat literally made of clouds. At a marina in the city of Greenstone, it was moored amidst the pleasure craft of Greenstone's wealthy and aristocratic elite. The Cloud House had been the much-vied-for prize in the Reaper Trials, a deadly contest in an otherworldly realm. Jason and his teammates had managed to beat out some of the finest young adventurers in the world. Jason's team had no illusions that they were better than the many outstanding young people they had competed against, knowing that luck and circumstance played a large role in their victory. After a celebratory trip away where they consolidated their gains from the contest, their new objective was training. The young team had experienced success, but they had a long way to go, both as individuals and as a team. Jason and his teammate Humphrey Geller were the first to rise each morning. Jason made the team breakfast while Humphrey plotted out the day's training. As the teams were magical beings transformed by the essences they had all consumed, they were able to sustain themselves on spirit coins and go without food entirely. Humphrey liked the effect on morale and team cohesion that eating breakfast altogether had, while Jason just liked breakfast. When Emir Bahadir had presented Jason with the magical item that created the Cloud House, he had warned that it would be something of a money pit. The Cloud House was capable of reproducing all manner of amenities, from showers to ovens to windows that could function like a telescope. In order to activate these functions, however, Jason needed to supply magical resources, usually in the form of magic quintessence gems, water quintessence for bathroom amenities, fire, iron, and glass for a stove and oven. Jason had already poured a small fortune into it. The ability to call a grill right up out of the deck, the cloud stuff the house was made of, shifting to meet his needs, made Jason think it was completely worth the cost. For someone for whom cooking was such an important part of his life, it was a delightful convenience. "I love being rich," Jason muttered happily, as he flipped hotcakes on the grill.
"What was that?"
Humphrey asked, looking up distractedly.
"Nothing,"
Jason said, raising a clenched fist.
"Seize the means of production."
"What are you talking about?"
Humphrey asked.
"Nothing, it's fine," Jason said, turning his attention back to the hotcakes.
"I'm a really hypocritical socialist," he muttered to himself. "I like money way too much." They were out on the open deck, Jason working the grill as Humphrey sat at a nearby table, looking over the meticulous notes he had taken on the team's training. Winter was pleasant in Greenstone, with mild temperatures and less mugginess pressing in from the wet jungle delta, magically sustained in the middle of a bone-dry desert. The sky was a gorgeous empty blue, with a crystal clarity to the winter air that even the brightest summer day couldn't match.
"Looks like a nice one today," Jason said, looking up.
"You're right," Humphrey said.
"How about we do some outside training? Maybe focus on mobility training?"
"Works for me,"
Jason said.
"Did you schedule that matchup against Beth's team?"
"It won't be for a few days," Humphrey said. "We aren't the only ones in a training frenzy after the Reaper trials. The Mirage Chamber is heavily booked."
Like everyone who safely returned from the Reaper trials, the Geller family teams had brought back a treasure trove of Awakening Stones to unlock new magical abilities and complete their power sets. Danielle Geller had received the same forewarning as Jason had about the chance for unusual Awakening Stones. Most adventurers who faced the trials now had a Reaper ability in their repertoire, as almost everyone who survived had been awarded an otherwise extremely rare Awakening Stone of the Reaper. This included both Jason and Humphrey, with Jason having even picked up a second one. The rare stones didn't awaken inherently more powerful abilities, but having a little-known power in their toolkit could be a trump card for any adventurer. This slew of new and little-seen powers had excited Jason and Humphrey's teammate, Clive. As an enthusiastic proponent of the Magic Society's effort to catalogue all known powers, Clive and his dogged questions were now being actively avoided. He had also urged their teammate Belinda to shapeshift into Jason, in an attempt to replicate the interface power that allowed him to look at detailed descriptions of magical abilities.
To his frustration, she always ended up with the wrong power and could only replicate Jason's map ability.
"The map is a great power," Jason had insisted when Clive had complained to him.
"Not for administrative purposes," Clive had bemoaned.
"I think you and I look at the potential of magic powers in very different ways," Jason told him. Humphrey and Jason chatted while going about their morning tasks, until Jason spotted a familiar but unexpected figure. She was walking along the marina pier towards the houseboat.
"Humphrey," Jason said, "your ex is coming by."
"My ex?" Humphrey asked.
He spotted Gabrielle as she approached the houseboat. Gabrielle Pellin was a priestess of the god of knowledge, as well as Humphrey's extremely beautiful ex-lover. Gabrielle and Jason had originally gotten along, but she wasn't the first person whose strong religious views had placed her in a position antagonistic to Jason. Jason regretted the part that played in souring Humphrey's relationship with her. He respected Humphrey for having the strength to end things with someone who stood out even in a world full of people made beautiful by magic. Jason doubted he could have made as mature a choice when he was 17. Jason invited Gabrielle aboard. The open deck areas of the houseboat didn't require the boat to take an aura imprint before granting access.
"Gabrielle," Humphrey greeted, a complicated expression on his face.
"Hello, Humphrey," she said.
Dressed in a plain version of the robes of her church, she was clearly trying to be stoic, but couldn't hide her tense body language. Steeling herself, she turned to Jason.
"The goddess has a new gift for you," she said. "I'm here to deliver it."
"Is it strippers?"
Jason asked. "Not you, you're too young. Other strippers, but roughly the same level of hotness." Humphrey and Gabrielle both gave him horrified looks.
"What?"
he asked innocently.
"Ignore him. My lady wants me to tell you that objectification jokes are beneath you,"
Gabrielle said to Jason.
"Yeah," Jason said with a chuckle. "But you shouldn't trust someone who doesn't spend at least a little time in the gutter."
"I very much disagree," Gabrielle said.
"Colour me surprised. So, what does your boss have for me? I'll admit I'm a little trepidatious after the last time."
Jason had made a deal with the goddess of knowledge that she would give him a gift in return for not introducing his very poor grasp of the physical sciences into this one. Her first attempt at a gift was received as poorly as Jason understood the gravity he had tried to explain to Clive.
"She recognized your concerns,"
Gabrielle said, clearly unhappy,
"and has prepared a new gift you should find more palatable. You should know that this gift edges against the boundaries of her own rules, consideration that you do not deserve."
"What do you mean?"
Gabrielle opened her dimensional satchel and pulled out books, one after another, piling them on the table next to Humphrey's notes.
"This knowledge is the answer to a question you don't yet know to ask,"
Gabrielle said, as she continued taking out books.
"This pushes the limits of what she is willing to do. Further, this knowledge is not of this world. She was reticent to give it to anyone, but you are not of this world either."
"Not of this world?" Humphrey asked.
"The Builder cultists have been bestowed knowledge from beyond this reality," Gabrielle said. "Now that it is here, she is sharing it with you."
"Ah," Jason said. "I know she likes this world to develop knowledge for itself, which is why she offered to bribe me in the first place. The Builder cult doesn't care about that, though, and now the genie's out of the bottle."
"What would a genie be doing in a bottle?"
Humphrey asked.
"Wait, genies are a thing?" Jason asked. "Do they grant wishes?"
"No, that would be outrageous.
Do they grant wishes where you come from?"
"Just in stories," Jason said, then turned back to Gabrielle. "So, this knowledge is something that comes from the Builder?"
"Yes. Once the knowledge was known by someone in this world, it became part of the goddess. She personally transcribed these tomes for delivery to you."
Humphrey's eyes went wide.
"The goddess made these personally?"
"Yes," Gabrielle confirmed, as she took out a small wooden case. She opened it to reveal neat rows of recording crystals.
"She also created these and the information contained within. She would have produced all these as skill books that you could absorb more quickly, but knew you would reject them."
"I would," Jason said. "I won't imprint things directly into my mind that came from sources I don't entirely trust. So, what is all this knowledge?"
The goddess recommends you turn to your friend Clive for assistance. She anticipates he will be quite enthusiastic.
He always is,
Jason said as he picked up a random book and opened it. It looked to be some kind of magical theory, at a level well above what he could pass at a glance. He closed the book and set it back down. Thank you, he said. I'm not really sure of the ramifications of this gift, but given the source, I expect it to be quite specifically useful. Gabrielle shook her head. I am constantly at a loss as to why the goddess feels you warrant such consideration.
You and me both, sister.
You want to stick around for pancakes? Gabrielle gave Humphrey an uncertain glance, then shook her head. I have further duties to attend to. I shall take my leave here.
Rufus stirred back to consciousness under the effect of his mother Arabelle's potent healing magic. He was lying on the sandy shore of the island where the group of adventurers had confronted the Builder cultists. The last thing he remembered was challenging a cultist far more powerful than himself, the man who killed Farah. He had put everything into one great blow, which had been almost but not quite enough. The last thing he remembered was falling unconscious, not expecting to ever wake up.
We won, then? He groaned. We were already on the way when we saw your field of darkness go up, and then that huge beam, his father said. We finished off that silver rancor, but he was close to done when we found him. I pretty much just poked him, and he fell down dead.
Rufus closed his eyes and drew a sharp, ragged breath. The man, the inhuman thing, who killed Farah, was dead. Gabriel gave him a proud smile, placing a warm hand on Rufus's shoulder.
You did it, son. Fantastic job.
What your father means, Arabelle said, with a pointed look at Gabriel, is that you never should have confronted an enemy like that.
Exactly, Gabriel said. Terrible job, son. Don't do it again.
Arabelle shook her head at her menfolk.
I think it's time for another child, husband. A daughter this time.
I'd love a little girl, Gabriel said. What essence should we give her? How about a whip essence? I saw a student at the academy doing some very interesting things with one just recently.
I think you're skipping a little far ahead, dear.
What about the cultists? Rufus asked.
A lot of them made it through the portals,
Callum said. Rufus hadn't even realized he was there, which was normal for the stealthy adventurer.
We got most of the leadership,
Callum continued.
The count came up with one silver ranker less than my initial count, so they likely escaped amongst the lower rank masses.
Prisoners?
Rufus asked.
None, Gabriel said. The cultists did the usual self-detonating crystal star thing. Before they did that, though, they killed off the priests amongst them.
Killing their own allies, Arabelle said, shaking her head. I hate fighting zealots.
We have plenty of recordings of Purity's clergy consorting with the cultists, though,
Callum said.
More than enough for the other churches to form an ecumenical council and forcibly investigate.
Rufus pushed himself to his feet.
So, what now?
He asked.
Now we bring in everyone else. We need to identify the dead, see if it leads us to more cultists. Give the Magic Society a chance to figure out where these portals go. As for us, we can head back to the city.
For Jason and his team, days of unrelenting training turned into weeks as their potential slowly transmuted into capability. This included regular practice against other teams in the Mirage Chamber. Beth Cavendish's team was likewise improving rapidly, beating them less than half the time, but with only 5 members to 6 on Jason's team. Padma was a half-disciple of Jason's dead friend Farah, with a team made up of Rufus's juniors from the Remor Academy. They were interested in testing themselves against Jason, the person Rufus and Farah had trained personally. At first, their conflicts were one-sided in favor of the Remor Academy elites, but Jason's team advanced in leaps and bounds until they were winning as much as they lost. Padma's team was standoffish at first, and all the more so after they rolled over Jason's team in their early encounters. They opened up as Jason and his team solidly proved their worth.
although their draconian member remained stolid in his disdain for Humphrey and his dragon essence. Their shapeshifter, Natalie, struck up a friendship with Belinda, who had only gained her powers and joined the team after the Reaper trials. Natalie was a valuable voice of experience for Belinda in the specialized area of shape-changing. Padma's team leader, in the meantime, built up a rivalry with Valdis. Both were sword specialists, with almost identical essence combinations, but they were very different swordsmen. Valdis had the classic combination of sword, swift, and adept, which produced the master confluence. Each essence was common, but with legends like Rufus's grandfather using the combination, no one would look down on it. Valdis was very much a swordsman of that tradition. He had an array of special attacks that, at a glance, seemed very similar. It was a high-skill power set that lived or died on the user's grasp of nuance. Lance, Padma's team leader, was an elf. His essences, which were sword, myriad, and adept, also produced the master confluence. He possessed the elven aptitude for spells, rather than the special attacks in which humans specialized, resulting in a wholly different combat style from Valdis. The elf could not match Valdis toe-to-toe, but he had no need to. He was far from weak in hand-to-hand combat, but his powers gave him the freedom to fight at any range. Mixing spells into his swordsmanship, he could duplicate himself, conjure dancing blades to fight for him, or fire waves of razor-sharp force from a distance. Of the two swordsmen, the more experienced Valdis edged out his opponent more often than not, although Lance would score his own points as well. Valdis and his team maintained a perfect record against Jason's in the Mirage Arena, although what began as a series of thrashings slowly became actual battles. To hear Valdis talk, however, enjoying post-fight drinks on the houseboat, anyone would think he was the one losing. "Your team is terrible to fight against," he said to Jason. "You're running around like an invisible, teleporting plague, while your familiar is trying to burn down our healer. Normally, my job is to put down problems like that, but that damn woman is made of the wind. How does an immovable object move that quickly? That's not how immovable objects work." "You do realize you won, right?" Jason asked him. "She head-butted my sword. That shouldn't be possible. And what's with that woman who's everything? She had a wand in one hand and a shield in the other, which doesn't seem like something people should be allowed to do." "I'm pretty sure that's not a rule." "Once she hit me with my own power. My own power. Being able to take on different roles is one thing, but none of those roles should be me."
"Calm down," Sigrid told him. "You're spilling your drink."
In the wake of the Reaper trials, the city of Greenstone had a relative flood of essences and awakening stones. The foreign adventurers largely took their gains and went home, but many locals had also participated. Most had never intended to vie for the ultimate prize, but instead plundered the astral space for as much treasure as they could carry away. As a result, the market price of essences and stones reached an all-time low. With so many essences and awakening stones entering the market, Greenstone's novice adventurer population was undergoing a surge. Families that previously could only dream of having an adventurer in their ranks were pooling their resources to buy essence sets for their most promising young people. It made for a strong first step towards replenishing the numbers diminished by the losses of the disastrous expedition. The city's more powerful criminals were also taking the chance to add powerful henchmen to their rosters. The ramifications of the expedition to the astral space that claimed so many adventurers' lives were still being felt in the ongoing presence of the Adventure Society Inquiry. The inquiry had begun with sweeping demotions, after which they had put the branch records through a sieve, while so many adventurers were away at the Reaper trials. Once they returned, the inquiry commenced interviews, sometimes with individuals and other times with groups. Finally, the Adventure Society had started re-evaluations, assessing the demoted adventurers one by one to reinstate their rank, confirm the demotion, or even revoke their membership altogether. This brought a sense of hopelessness, but for most, their demotions were confirmed. When memberships were revoked, it was not a matter up for appeal. The lobbying to do so from certain sectors was swiftly and emphatically rebuffed. Other concerns were at a level that iron rankers like Jason and his team were uninvolved, although the team's connections kept them abreast of goings-on. The Builder cult was on the back foot, at least locally. The cult had been purged from the city and, after several costly ambushes, had halted their supply raids in the Delta.
The escapees from the island raid were still at large, however. Stories rolled in of the cult's activities around the world, and tension built as the city awaited the revelation of their next big move. The Church of Purity was under more scrutiny than any church would ordinarily have to tolerate. An ecumenical council of the other churches sanctioned them, launching a sweeping inquiry. Their temple was searched and all manner of materials seized. The church officially maintained that their members present at the island raid were a schism faction, denounced by their god. Claims of a few isolated bad apples rang hollow, however, as similar revelations were made about the Church of Purity all around the world. Certain individuals stood out, either by their absence or the issues in which current events embroiled them. A number of key members of the Church of Purity seemed to have vanished on previously scheduled sabbaticals. These absentees included the Church of Purity's Archbishop, Nicholas Hendren, Anissa LaSalle, and almost the entire LaSalle family, who were some of the Purity Church's strongest supporters. Those that remained claimed no knowledge of where their spiritual journeys had taken them. Jason was especially delighted to hear about Lucian Lamprey scrambling to absolve himself. Lamprey's personal intervention in handing the star seed over to the Church of Purity was suddenly the object of significant scrutiny. The time-displaced priests Jason had released from the astral space during the Reaper trials were an unusual new presence in the city. Most were absorbed into their various churches, but the former members of the Church of Purity were another matter, having been rejected by their now former god. As Jason predicted, the Adventure Society had taken their disposition in hand. Given the troubles faced by the church that rejected them, the priests were a rather awkward presence within the city. Those priests who had some of their powers gifted to them by their god had those powers revoked, which left them with dangerously imbalanced power. Those who had the greatest level of power and those who had many of their powers revoked suffered the worst. Until they replaced the missing powers, they would all suffer, and their strength would never return to its previous level unless they found a new god to replace their missing abilities. One group of the former purists dedicated themselves to regaining entry to the Church of Purity. They were undaunted by the new revelations about their church, but their dedication was flatly rebuffed. A small number of these even turned to suicide in their despair, rather than accept exclusion. Others sought positions in other churches, many finding success. The rest eventually came to accept the need to start over and accepted new ordinary essences. With the market at record lows, the Adventure Society provided common essences for free as an act of mercy. Whatever their situation and whatever their faith, every member now freed from the astral space had to decide on their own future. They had all been born before Greenstone was founded, and needed to find a new way in what was to them a new world. Everyone they had known and loved was long gone. Most took passage to their homelands, even knowing that there was no one and nothing waiting for them. The priests whose gods had welcomed them back at least had a path. Their churches placed them locally or sent them off to distant branches of their faith. Others, mostly former purists who came to accept their abandonment, decided to start over in Greenstone. They took the essences they were offered, even if they were cheap and less than ideal. Many, purist and otherwise, rejected their former faith with ferocity. They were filled with resentment at the gods who had sent them into that place and cost them everything and everyone they had known. They had a new attitude towards the gods that made Jason seem pious by comparison. All the recovered clergy, excommunicated or not, had a variety of attitudes towards Jason. As he was the agent of their liberation, they were largely grateful, although to wildly varying degrees. Some felt that he only released them as an afterthought. Some even resented him for their current situation. Most were more gracious, however, often thanking him in person as he wandered about the Adventure Society campus. There was even a small contingent of the freed priests who viewed him as their savior, especially after the gods had publicly appeared to thank him in person. One day, Jason and his team returned from their training to find Rufus drinking out on the deck of the houseboat with Vincent, the Adventure Society official with the outrageous mustache. The pair had previously maintained a casual relationship, although not as much since Farrah's death. Vincent's busy schedule and Rufus's driving obsession had left them seeing little of one another. After confronting Farrah's killer and being largely responsible for his death, Rufus was finally starting to move forward. They were not alone. Gary and his friend Russell, an artificer from the Magic Society, sat with them. "Jason," Vincent greeted.
Your reassessment interview with the Adventure Society has been scheduled. I thought I'd come and tell you in person.
All right, Jason said. Any idea if I'll be getting my old rank back?
The issue is that you're very loud for an Iron Ranker, Vincent said. They're going to want a display of humility.
No worries, Jason said. No one's as good at being humble as me.
Chapter 2. Looking Forward. In the clinic waiting room, Jason chatted with Jory's assistant, Janice, until Jory emerged with a patient from the treatment rooms in the back.
Jason, Jory greeted him cheerfully, after sending the patient on her way. It's good to see you in person instead of just hearing you through your voice chat power. You know that weird message popping up to say you want to contact me can be disturbing, right?
Disturbing?
Remember the other day you tried to contact me and I refused?
I figured you were busy with a patient.
I was in the bath. It felt like you were watching me. That was creepy.
Sometimes I just don't have time for a personal visit. The team's been busy with training.
That much I know. I've barely seen Belinda lately.
Can you spare me a few minutes now? Jason asked.
Jory glanced around the waiting room, which was around half full, then gave Janice a questioning glance.
A few minutes shouldn't throw things too badly off, she said. A few minutes.
Come on, Jory said. I'll make us some tea. Would you like one, Janice?
That would be lovely, she said with a sweet smile.
Jory led Jason back into the room he and whatever healer priest was on duty used to relax if things got too tense. It had a large cooler box and cupboards full of snacks and beverages. A large window looked out onto the courtyard where Jason, Rufus, Gary, and Farah used to train. Far from the dirt yard it was back then, now it was nicely tiled, with standing and wall planters adding pleasant greenery.
We've come a long way, Jory said, following Jason's gaze. It was only in the summer that you were hopelessly lost, madly training in a dirty back lot. Now this place is a thriving medical center, and you're a big-time adventurer.
This is only the beginning, Jason said. Now I'm looking towards bronze rank. I think I can get there before I've been here a year. I definitely can if the monster surge comes. All those monsters in that astral space sent my abilities shooting up. Same for everyone who doesn't use monster cores.
I know, Jory said. Mine did the same. I've never had the money to go spending on monster cores, and I'm definitely not interested in hunting for them.
You've got the skills, Jason said. But I think you're in the right place. There's plenty of us out there killing monsters. We need more people like you helping those who need it the most. I really admire you for that.
Thanks, Jason. That means a lot.
Also, I need 40 gallons of crystal wash.
Wait, what? 40 gallons?
If I could get it in a barrel, that would be good. Maybe one of those big kegs that Norwich uses in his brewery. The ones with the little tap. That would be convenient.
Are you insane? Are you trying to soak your whole houseboat in the stuff?
Actually, I kind of am, Jason said. Emiya warned me that it would require certain additional materials, especially early on, to fuel the various amenities. The cloud stuff automatically cleans itself and anything in it. Have you ever noticed how you get out of the cloud bed feeling like you've just had a refreshing shower?
I have no idea what you're talking about, Jory said, unconvincingly.
Jory, we all know about you and Belinda.
You do? I mean, what?
Jory, I'm connected to the houseboat. I know anyone who comes aboard and where they are at all times. Even if I didn't, Humphrey and I have been watching you sneak off in a disheveled state every morning. I don't even know why you're hiding it. There's nothing to be ashamed of.
I wouldn't want to impinge on her reputation.
Jory, she's a convicted criminal.
I was raised a certain way, Jory said, defensively. I was taught that there's a proper process to courting a lady.
Why didn't you do that then?
I was working up to it. Then she kind of grabbed me and dragged me off to her room.
At least one of you is sensible, Jason said.
Anyway, the cloud beds. Like everything else on the houseboat, the cloud stuff cleans whatever's in it. Unfortunately, the houseboat has used up whatever resources it started with for cleaning.
Emiya warned me that a lot of resources would need topping off early, and now I need a bunch of purgation quintessence and a huge supply of crystal wash. Luckily, most of the Purity Temple's assets were seized, and Clive reckons he can get his hands on the quintessence I need. That just leaves the crystal wash. Jason, that amount is crazy. 40 gallons. At least. Now, I know for a fact that you massively increased the production with all those fancy foreign nobles in town. I'm willing to bet you have a decent amount stockpiled away. I sold most of it, Jory said. Prince Valdis buys almost as much of the stuff as you. Jory looked at Jason's annoying grin, scratching the back of his head absently as he let out a sigh. I can probably sort something out, he conceded. I'm going to repurpose the production space currently used on Crystal Wash for the Lesser Miracle Potion, but I'm still sourcing the materials I need. That will be the engine to fund the clinic going forward. I suppose I could keep production of Crystal Wash up until then. I could have that much for you by the end of the month. Thanks, Jason said gratefully. I'll pay full price instead of the usual mate's rates. I'll be taking up a good chunk of your production after all. That's appreciated, Jory said. Getting the Church of the Healer's assistance has been great, but we still run some tight margins. That miracle potion money will be coming in eventually, but I use the last of the leftover funding from the renovations to import all the materials. Seems like the more money we make, the more we need, right? No kidding, Jory said. Where are your costs coming in? Aside from the gaping money chasm that is my cloud house? Preparing for bronze rank. I don't know when I'll be able to get back to a big city, so while I was away, I picked up the materials to resummon my familiars at bronze. I thought I'd be flush with coin after auctioning off those essences, but I've pretty much got it all earmarked for preparing new gear, the houseboat, summoning rituals. It just goes on and on. Jason let out a weary groan. I should let you get back to it then. I need to go spend some more money. You aren't training today? Jory asked. Humphrey and I are both having our rank reassessments at the Adventure Society this afternoon, Jason said. We decided to give the others a rest day. You should knock off early. Go see Belinda. In fact, the symphony is playing tonight. Take her and use my private viewing booth. You have a private booth? I go whenever I get the chance, Jason said. That hasn't been as much as I'd like lately. I'll swing by and make sure they know to let you use it. You have a good suit, right, Jory? Oh dear, Jason said, shaking his head. He took a carousel of recording crystals from his inventory, looking through them until he picked one out. He told Jory to stand still. What are you doing? Jory asked as Jason moved slowly around him, waving the crystal up and down his body. This is a specialized recording crystal to take clothing measurements, Jason told him. I know a guy who'll do a rush job for me without compromising quality. You're lucky he's actually my next stop. You carry around a crystal specifically for clothing measurements. A good adventurer is always prepared.
Mr. Asano, welcome back.
Gilbert lit up as Jason entered Gilbert's resilient attire for the discerning gentleman.
Like all good adventurers, you have excellent timing, Gilbert continued. I was just having a meal, take everything to the fitting room.
You've reached iron rank, Jason said, shaking Gilbert's hand. Finally picked up that last essence. The paunchy, middle-aged man had lost considerable weight, and the hair was much thicker on his head.
Yes, I finally went and did it, Gilbert said. All my cloth essence abilities hit bronze years ago, but I was resistant to more essences for a long time. Never seemed quite right to take essences that others could make use of to help people. Age and health are humbling, however, and with the market the way it is right now, I took the opportunity. I've been absorbing monster cores, but I'm still a long way from bronze and the extra years it will buy me.
Gilbert led Jason into the generous fitting room, just as his assistant appeared, pushing a long rack of clothes from the back room on a wheeled trolley. As Emil departed to fetch the next one, Gilbert started showing Jason the outfits.
Your winter wardrobe, Gilbert declared. As requested, this is largely in the Vitesse style, with the flourishes we discussed previously.
Jason had long admired Emiya's dress sense, which he discovered was largely down to Constance. She had been kind enough to consult when Jason decided to buy his clothes for the cooler months. Between her advice and Gilbert's expertise, Jason's winter wardrobe was sleek, fitted, and sharp. The colours were more earthy and sober than local greenstone fashion, which favoured explosions of bright hues. It was engaging to work with something different to the local palette, Gilbert said. I'm quite satisfied with the result.
So you should be, Jason said, with admiration. You've outdone yourself, Bert.
Thank you, sir. With the mild winters here, mid-weight fabrics are perfect. Included, of course, are some subtle enchantments to maintain the comfort level whether the day trends hot or cool. Of course, there is a selection of outfits that trend one way or the other. I have included an array of winter colours in the Vitesse fashion, dark greens and burgundies, the expected blacks, greys and blues. Some very nice browns, dark and rich, as well as a deep caramel Miss Constance referred to as brandy. I've also included some lighter selections, of course, and the expected formal wear for various occasions. Jason started putting the clothes away in his dimensional storage, opening the outfits tab of his inventory and placing each ensemble into its own set. Is there anything else I can do for you today? Gilbert asked as Jason stowed one outfit after another. Actually, yes, Jason said. A couple of things. One is a rush job, just some basic formal wear for a friend that you can put on my tab. You have his measurements? Gilbert asked. Of course, Jason said. I picked up the crystal you suggested. Very good. The other job is non-urgent, Jason said. It's time I started looking ahead and thinking about bronze rank. My combat robe is fantastic, but I will need to upgrade once I rank up. Well-made adventuring garb is about matching material and craftsmanship to purpose, Gilbert said. You are wise to start thinking about it now so we can put together exactly what you need. Actually, there's something I've been keeping up my sleeve for a long time, Jason said. He continued taking outfits off the racks and putting them away in his inventory as Emil hauled out more trolleys. Three were hanging racks, while a fourth was a box trolley packed with underclothes and other sundry items. You got the love hearts on the boxer shorts just right, Jason said, as he rubbed the material between his fingers. This texture is incredible. You were spot on to suggest the Mist Valley silk. I import a large supply each year, Gilbert said. I found it to be an exceptional choice for underclothes with our particular winter climate. Jason started looping ties around his neck, tying the knot before adding one to each outfit. He matched the knot to the outfit, whether a simple four-in-hand knot, a nice clean Pratt knot, or a bold full Windsor. He even added a flamboyant Trinity knot to a couple of the most outgoing outfits. I must confess, Mr. Asano, I was uncertain about the noose, but it does have a way of bringing an outfit together. How many times, Bert? It's a tie, not a noose. I was concerned that your opponents might not see it that way should you find yourself in an unexpected engagement, Mr. Asano. This shop provides resilient attire for the discerning gentleman, after all. I had an enchantment placed on the ties to prevent them from being used to choke you. Very considerate, Bert. Consideration is my watchword. As it turns out, though, I don't actually need to breathe. Do you need to chant spells? Gilbert asked. That's a fair point, Jason acknowledged. After putting everything away, dark smoke manifested around him briefly before vanishing to reveal Jason in one of his new outfits. Looking himself over in a full-length mirror, he adjusted his tie slightly. I may not be an impartial judge, Mr. Asano, but I would say you look very dapper. To Jason's eye, it had more of a gothic flair compared to a suit from his old world, with the patterned embroidery of the vest and the flourishes on the long jacket that swept in at the waist before reaching down to mid-thigh. He gave a little shuffle, finding his movement utterly unimpeded. The shoes looked formal and stylish, but felt like athletic footwear. Superlative, Bert. You're a credit to your profession. Thank you, Mr. Asano. I have a meeting with the Adventure Society, so I think I'll wear it out. Of course. Before you go, Mr. Asano, you mentioned having something up your sleeve. Right, yes, Jason said. He wandered over to a table at the side of the room and retrieved a large bolt of dark material from his inventory. I've been holding onto this for a while. What do you make of it, Bert? Bert moved next to Jason and ran his finger lightly over the material. It was dark, matte, and cool to the touch. Snakeskin, he said.
Umbral, snake, probably the mountain variety. Strong affinities for darkness and poison. Bronze rank, and it's infused with some kind of odd magic. It almost feels intrinsic, rather than externally imposed, but... Gilbert frowned. Was this a familiar?
It was, Jason said. Is that a problem?
In terms of the value of the material, just the opposite, Gilbert said. My concerns are ethical. You don't get familiars without essence users. You're aware of the people running around causing trouble in the astral spaces?
Cultists or something,
Gilbert's assistant said from where he stood to the side.
It's almost all anyone wants to talk about these days.
Yes, Gilbert said, giving his assistant a nod. The competition held by the gold ranker distracted people for a while. Congratulations again, by the way. But they're back to all this unnerving talk. Strange forces from beyond reality and the mad men that worship them. It's as unpleasantly disconcerting as it is monotonous. Fear isn't a look that matches any outfit to be found in this store.
Fear is to be expected, Jason said.
The threat is real, and it falls to more powerful people than us to stop it. About half a year ago, however, I ran across one of those cultists, and he tried to kill me. After he died, his familiar tried to kill me too. He patted the material. This is its skin.
Good riddance, then, Gilbert said.
We should see if we can't make something of it to help you deal with more of them.
If the familiar was bronze rank, Emil said, then the cultist must have been as well, right?
That's right, Jason said.
You're only iron rank, though, Emil said.
Back then, I wasn't even that. Didn't even have my first essence.
Then how did you beat them?
Emil asked. I got lucky, Jason said. Things that attack me have this way of ending up dead.
Do go on, Emil, Gilbert said, dismissing his assistant.
Yes, boss. Can I ask you something before I go, Mr. Asano?
Emil, Gilbert admonished. It's fine, Jason said. Go ahead, Emil.
Did all those gods really appear to thank you in person?
Gods turning up is hardly a big deal, Jason said. Spend some time at the Divine Square, they pop up with fair regularity. And I'd hardly call it all those gods when it was barely a half dozen. Out with you, Gilbert said, shooing his assistant out of the fitting room. He'll be telling that story all over, Mr. Asano. You've built up quite the reputation with recent events. A local boy beating out all those fancy foreign adventurers. Princes and princesses, no less.
I'm not exactly local, Jason said. In fact, I'm about as far from local as it comes.
You're local now, Gilbert said with a laugh. You've been co-opted. Nothing earns goodwill like success. So, this material is something you can work with?
I certainly can. If you're willing to leave it with me, I can investigate the best options.
Good, because it was a pretty big snake, Jason said, taking out a second bolt of the material.
Oh my, Gilbert said. There's certainly enough for two sets of armor here. Probably three, possibly even four, depending on how we use it. Were you looking at spares, or do you want something for your agile lady friend as well? This material should be useful for something that would suit her. Sophie, like Jason, used highly flexible armor made from trap weaver leather. Gilbert only catered to the discerning gentleman, but had a lady friend of his own. On Gilbert's recommendation, they had taken the trap weaver leather to Brenda's Massacre Emporium, elsewhere in the trade hall. Sophie might want something that better combines flexibility and defense, Jason said. Stealth and poison doesn't fit her power set.
Then would you like me to take the liberty of keeping an eye out for appropriate materials? I can have Brenda do the same.
That would be great, Jason said.
For the whole team, in fact. How about I have them come in for a chat so you know what to look for?
A prescient idea, Mr. Asano.
Chapter 3. Adventurers are people too. Jason rode the elevating platform up through the Adventure Society administration building, arriving on the fifth floor. There was a new reception desk, installed as part of the changes implemented by the inquiry team. Behind the desk was a familiar face.
Bert, Jason greeted him. They've moved you upstairs. Is it the new essences?
It is, Albert said.
Getting the full set is the way off the bottom rung in the Adventure Society, or anywhere else for that matter. Seems the higher-ups liked that I didn't let them take Miss Sophie away when she was locked up in the prison tower.
Miss Sophie and myself both appreciated as well, Jason said. It's nice to see integrity being rewarded.
Is that one of the suits Gilbert was making for you? Albert asked.
It certainly is.
Well, if you don't mind me saying, Mr. Asano, you're looking quite sharp.
Thank you, Jason said. We have a saying where I come from, the suit makes the man. In a characteristic display of Bertinelli family excellence, your brother has made quite the man of me.
Thank you for saying, Mr. Asano. You can go ahead and wait in the conference room.
I know the way. Thanks, Bert.
Jason went through to the conference room and sat down to wait. In the meantime, he pulled out a hefty tome of magical theory, opening to where he had marked his place with a ribbon, and started reading. It wasn't one of the new books that Gabrielle had handed over, as they were too advanced, but a more foundational text he inherited from Farah. The books the Goddess of Knowledge had delivered to him fell directly into Clive's field of astral magic, all focused on one specific aspect, dimensional transgression. Portals, teleportation, and even the basic theories of passing between worlds. Clive had almost exploded with surprise when he first perused the books to glean their purpose.
I don't know if this is enough to get you to your world or back, Clive had excitedly told Jason, but it gets us orders of magnitude closer.
Clive had been spending every moment not training buried in the books. These books, built on work he found amongst Landemir Vane's notes, seized back from the Church of Purity. Jason closed the book and put it away as the door opened to admit Elspeth Arella and Tabitha Gert, the stern-faced leader of the inquiry team. He stood up to greet them. Arella shook her head upon seeing that Jason had been sitting at the head of the table.
Arella, he said with a nod. Interim director?
Actually, Gert said. Director Arella has resumed her full duties as the inquiry comes towards a close. You may address me by my regular rank of inspector.
Very well, inspector, Jason said.
Jason took in Gert at a glance, from the tightly bound hair and prim plain clothes to the way her cold eyes surveyed her surroundings and seemed to find them wanting. Her resting expression exuded disapproval, as if she had a general expectation that the world at large would fail to live up to her standards. Given his style of interpersonal relations, Jason had learned to swiftly assess how people would respond to his particular brand of provocative insouciance. He recognized immediately that the inspector was the kind of person with zero tolerance for the informal affability that was his strong suit. With people like that, he would either crank it right up or dial it right back, depending on his needs. From everything he had heard, Tabitha Gert was a rigid but even-handed woman, carrying out her job with stark professionalism. Since he felt that integrity was deserving of respect, he kept his normal inclinations subdued. Gert waved Jason to one side of the table as she and Arella sat opposite.
Mr. Asano, Gert began. In the course of our inquiry into the general culture of this Adventure Society branch, your name has been appearing significantly more often than is appropriate for an Iron Ranker, which is to say, at all. Garnering the attention of the influential and powerful too soon in your career is an excellent way for that career to reach an early and ignominious end.
I agree, Jason said.
All I can say in my defense is that I made what I felt to be the right choice at each stage. I recognize, of course, that such a direction often leads to places I never intended or wanted to go. I'm told that is a common situation for outworlders to find themselves in. Gert nodded, although even that affirming action somehow came across as disapproving.
Your rank was reduced as part of the initial sweep of demotions, Gert said. From our brief initial assessments, your promotions had a smell of politics to them, that they were part of some kind of game Arella was playing.
Arella remained silent and impassive, not reacting to the mention of her name or the postulation on her motives.
I have no doubt that was a factor, Jason said. I like to think that my capabilities made it an easy pill to swallow, but naturally, that is not an impartial opinion.
Do you think you deserve 3 stars, Mr. Asano? Gert asked.
From what I've seen of the demands on adventurers, yes, at least at Iron Rank.
I'm inclined to agree,
Gert said, surprising Jason. She seemed built for delivering news you didn't want to hear.
I read your report on the contract surrounding the land in the forestry district. It was thorough and well documented. I look very favourably on thorough reports. Delivering that report directly to the upper levels of the administration was also well considered. Your handling of a politically delicate situation demonstrated sound judgment. You also took being excluded from a prestigious expedition with equanimity, putting your energy into completing contracts. At the Iron Rank level, this is more than sufficient to warrant a 3-star promotion.
I don't imagine things are quite that simple, though, Jason said.
Indeed. Frankly, you have demonstrated a capability above your rank. The problem is that in doing so, you've demonstrated that you consider your actual rank to be below you. I am aware that you surround yourself with bronze, silver, and even gold rankers, but you are not one of them. I have no doubt that you will climb higher should you survive that long. But before restoring your promotion, I would like to see a demonstration that you understand that you are, for the moment, an Iron Ranker.
Jason nodded. I surmise that something like this would come up during the reassessment, Jason said, and I've given it some consideration. I think I have a proposal that will work for everyone involved.
And what is this proposal, Mr. Asano?
A road contract, he said.
A punishment detail, Gert mused. Interesting.
My reputation is riding high right now, Jason said. Ostensibly, I should be swimming in accolades. But if you assign me a punishment detail and I eat it without complaint, then it will be a public demonstration of my respect for the Adventure Society's authority.
What's in it for you?
Arella asked, speaking for the first time since entering the room.
My team has been undergoing an intensive training period. Going out and facing some real-world challenges is exactly what we need right now. In my world, they call it a shakedown cruise. It will allow me to show some humility, season my team, and help some people along the way. A win all around, by my count.
A well-considered idea, Gert said. I approve.
I'll be choosing your scheduled route, Arella said. You can expect a lot more trudging through the desert than nice delta towns.
That's fine. I would appreciate if it included Northeast Quarry Village 4, if that's possible. I made some friends there a while ago, and it would be nice to check in.
Arella looked slightly peeved at Jason, welcoming her condition so readily. Are you sure you can get your team to eat being placed on punishment detail with you? She asked.
We're already making plans, Jason said. If you don't give us one, we'll probably roam around clearing off adventure board notices anyway.
Very well, Gert said. You will be assigned a road contract. Contingent on it being carried out satisfactorily, your promotion will be reinstated on its completion.
Thank you, Inspector.
Thank me by doing your job and doing it well, Mr. Asano. We are done here.
She stood up and departed without a further word. Arella followed, giving Jason a complicated and assessing look.
I'll have the details sent to you before the road contracts go out at the start of the month, she told him, and likewise left the room.
Jason made his own way out, returning to the reception desk.
How did you find the head of the inquiry team? Albert asked, when he paused for a chat.
Disconcertingly agreeable, Jason said. Albert raised an eyebrow.
That's the first time I've heard someone call her that, he said. The Duke hates her more than he hates Arella.
Really?
Oh, yes. She's completely rigid when it comes to Adventure Society rules and authority, but has a complete disregard for anything else. Local laws and authorities mean nothing to her. I've seen the Duke march in here more than once, only to leave more angry than he arrived.
Something worth knowing. Good looking out, Bert.
Valdis informed Jason and his team that they would soon be returning to the Mirror Kingdom. The two teams arranged one final match in the Geller family Mirage Chamber. Jason and Humphrey gathered their team on the houseboat to discuss strategy.
"I really want to win just once," Neil said. "Send him off knowing that we can stand alongside the best."
"That's easier to plan than execute," Humphrey said. "They're all close to bronze rank, more experienced, and have been working as a team for much longer. They've been able to take apart every strategy we've attempted by staying calm and responding with tactics that make efficient use of their superior power and practice teamwork."
"Then we disturb their calm," Neil said. "Hamper their efficiency, disrupt their teamwork. Surely you have something, Jason, disturbing people's calm as your life's work."
"Well, I was thinking about something," Jason said.
"Oh?" Humphrey prompted.
"We've been thinking about Valdis's team the wrong way," Jason said. "We've been strategizing as if they were collections of power and skill sets."
"You don't think we should strategize around their powers?"
"Of course, but we also need to look at them as people. Think about Valdis. We've been thinking of him as a high-speed, high-impact melee attacker and using Sophie to contain him. Trying to take him out doesn't make strategic sense. The effort to put him down would cost more than having him put down is worth compared to Sophie bundling him up."
"You think that's wrong?"
Sophie said.
"I do," Jason said.
"We haven't been thinking about them as people. Valdis isn't just a power set. He's a prince of the Mirror Kingdom. The whole team was built around him, the shaft to his spearhead."
"Oh,"
Humphrey said, eyes wide as revelation dawned.
"I get it. Disturb their calm."
"Would you mind filling in the rest of us?" Neil asked. "Strategically," Humphrey explained, "their team is built around their healer, Sigrid. She facilitates and directs strategy. We've tried piling onto her multiple times, but they have tried and tested strategies to defend against exactly that."
"This isn't new information," Belinda said.
"The strategic core of the team is Sigrid," Jason said, picking his explanation back up. "The political core, however, is Valdis, Prince of the Mirror Kingdom. He's the reason their team exists, and I promise you that in their heads, the central figure of the team isn't Sigrid, but him. This is our last shot at beating them until we go to the Mirror Kingdom someday and kick the snot out of them on their home turf. I'm willing to bet everything on the bottom line of Valdis's team being that he has to survive, whatever the cost."
"But this is a Mirage Chamber fight," Clive said. "He will survive."
"Yes," Humphrey said, "but those instincts have been ingrained for years. I can tell you right now, they were being prepared for Valdis's team before any of them ever received an essence."
"Exactly," Jason said.
"That disparity between the actual core of their team, Sigrid, and the core that's been drilled into them, Valdis, is the gap in their armor. If we go all in on Valdis right out of the gate, I bet they'll do the one thing we haven't been able to force out of them. They'll make a tactical mistake. Even if it's just a fleeting moment before their discipline kicks back in, that moment is our small but critical window."
"So we faint on Valdis, but actually move on Sigrid," Sophie said.
"Exactly," Jason said.
"We're going to have to really sell the feint," Humphrey said.
"That's well within our abilities," Jason said.
"The advantage we have on them is versatility. We adapt faster than they do to changes in circumstance, so we can switch our entire tactical approach faster than they can react. So long as we can get them to make that mistake, we can capitalize before they can cover for it."
"You think we'll win like this?" Sophie asked.
"From just this? No," Jason said. "They've been training together for years. There's a good chance they'll regroup and retake their formation, even in the face of everything we throw at them."
"Then we need to figure out how to stop that," Neil said.
"No," Jason said.
"We try and stop them because it would be suspicious if we didn't, but we don't succeed. We fight so hard to keep them scattered that they instinctively clump up all the more. If they're going to put so much effort into gathering together, it would be a waste not to use that against them. The advantage of never having our strategies work against them is they haven't seen them through to completion. It's time we showed Valdis and his team some of the trump cards we've never had a chance to pull out before."
Chapter 4. Valkyrie.
Valdis wildly fended off Humphrey's attacks. Behind him, Sigrid desperately healed their team members. Even using his smaller sword, Humphrey couldn't match Valdis's speed, but his strength was overwhelming. Valdis was more of a highly mobile striker than a defender, and could not meet the barrage of special attacks. This left him to a slow retreat as Sigrid fell back behind him. In their previous encounters, Valdis had always ended up fighting Sophie, while Humphrey used his heavy sword style to pressure the heavy defender from Valdis's team. He had dismissed Humphrey's swordsmanship as all power, no finesse. Now Humphrey used his smaller sword, stylized as an angelic wing. Despite the embellishments, it was still a practical, single-edged saber, flashing out with more rapid attacks than Valdis had seen from Humphrey in the past. When he first moved to protect Sigrid, Valdis assumed his superior skills would compensate for being forced into holding his ground. Only now did he remember that Humphrey's mother was a famous swordswoman. Humphrey's swordsmanship was every bit as rigorously trained as his own. If it were simply a duel, Valdis's mobility and experience at duels and lighter blades would have given him the edge. Forced to keep himself between Humphrey and Sigrid, however, the advantage fell to Humphrey, whose style was more suited to a standing clash. He pushed Valdis back step by step, with solid, unrelenting attacks. While Valdis unquestionably had the stronger team, the one advantage Jason and his allies had was versatility. They had seen almost every trick Valdis and his highly efficient cohort had to offer, while they had more up their own sleeves. Their ability to surprise was what had forced Valdis into the position he was now in. As the fight began, Sophie, who normally went after Valdis, had instead bolted away while the rest of her team had converged on him to sell the feint. Clive switch teleporting her with the heavy defender guarding Sigrid was the signal to give up the feint and move on her instead. The defender had not been worried. Displacing the defenders was a standard strategy he had faced before, and his abilities included a rapid movement power that allowed him to reposition as circumstances required. When he went to use it, however, he was yanked back like a dog trying to sprint but getting pulled up by the chain around his neck. He turned to look at what had jerked him back. There was a crystal rod sticking out of the ground, with a force tether connecting it to him. He launched into a charging special attack. It bounced off a force field around the rod, although he felt the impact weaken the field. At first, he failed to notice that another of his abilities suddenly became unavailable, as if he had used it as well. He was human and had no shortage of special attacks, so when he started unleashing them, the force field quickly started to buckle. When the field finally gave out, the crystal rod exploded, blasting him backwards. He was far too tough for that much to stop him, although he certainly felt it. It was not his first experience with the armor-penetrating feel of resonating force damage. He pushed himself swiftly to his feet, only then realizing that for every attack he had used, another power had been expended, including his critical movement powers. He recalled it was the effect of a curse levied by the strange role-shifting woman on the enemy team. With a grimace, he started running back in the direction of the main battle, encumbered by his heavy armor. Sigrid had suffered a near-fatal damage when Jason and his team had sprung their trap out of the feint against Valdis. As Jason predicted, her team had suffered a brief but critical moment of panic, leaving the slenderest of windows in which Sigrid was exposed to attack. Jason and his team had been primed for that moment, poised to switch gears the instant Valdis's team moved to protect him. Sigrid had barely kept herself alive through the use of a potent self-heal that would not be available again for hours. Even then, she was badly hurt and even suffered some afflictions. Humphrey's Spirit Reaper attack had pounded down her personal shield, giving Jason the chance to throw quick spells her way before the shield snapped back up. Both teams had 6 members, although their makeups were very different. Compared to Jason's eclectic and versatile team, Valdis had a traditional healer and heavy defender. The rest of his team were mobile and attack-focused, and they excelled in swift blitz tactics. Along with Valdis himself,